Cam and I are thrilled that Ballsy is sponsoring this episode of our True Crime Podcast. Ballsy has fun, high-quality products made right here in the USA that focus on below-the-belt care for men. Check them out at ballwash.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's going on?
That's what I was going to ask you.
Nothing. I'm getting ready to watch some of my episodes that I made notes on from the I Am a Killer on Netflix.
Netflix's I Am a Killer season 2, now out. So, you know, I got a couple revelations, reflections, if you will.
Reflections, yes.
Watching it kind of made me sad because I know everything now, which was kind of weird. I mean, not the people interviews, and I learned a lot, which takes me to my next point. I did make a few mistakes. Well, several, because that's my name. Cam Mistake. Duh. That's what the M stands for in there. But, you know, it wasn't in the material that I read about. So that was interesting to me to see that.
Well, then that's just a omission thing. That's not a mistake.
Yeah, but you know, it was interesting. I didn't know it. And like I said, some of these people were harder to find information on than other people. And another thing to note is when I did this, I based it off the episodes from the series when it ran in October over across the pond there in the UK, their UK. And so I assumed that's how it would be on Netflix because I can't believe that they'd recut the show and turn it around, but they did. So they didn't match out.
Oh, they changed episodes?
The order.
Episodes numbers? Oh.
The order that they
ran.
That's
weird. Like, did they start with I was going to say the left coast, the east coast and go?
No, you not know really. What I mean? Mm-mm. Huh. No. I don't know.
Very strange. Oh, well.
Yeah. Oh, well. So that's it. But anyway.
It's interesting. Yeah.
It is interesting. And it's, you know, yeah, it's, I feel like I cheated myself because I feel like I kind of, you know, even if I didn't include
you
it in the show.
It?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like reading the ending before the watching it. You know what I'm saying? But there's a lot more to it, like the interviews of the family members and victims and things like that.
Well, so, see, then that should be
totally
cool
is.
To do. I mean,
I think I've watched 4 episodes so far. Let me think. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 episodes so far. All right, Jen, what do you got for us today?
Today,
it's something else.
Today we kind of have, for me anyway, a very intriguing case. It is not only a murder, but it's also a missing person. And it's very old. Not very old. I mean,
like as old as you?
No, you were around. I wasn't because remember you.
See, I knew. I got you there before you could get me. I saw what you were gonna do.
But it happened before I was born. But I think you were born.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
It was before both of us was born. All right, you ready? Let's go.
I am so ready. Let's go.
So today we're heading back to 1962 to Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. The population then was about 6,000 people, and it really hasn't grown much in the past 60 years. Stroudsburg is the county seat of Monroe County, and its main industry is tourism, since it's right in the heart of the Pocono Mountain region of northwestern Pennsylvania. Now, they have a lot of shops, art galleries, restaurants, and hotels. Now, in the 1960s, the Poconos was a very popular vacation spot. It used to be known as the honeymoon capital of the world, and they had in-room champagne glass hot tubs and heart-shaped bathtubs. Remember that? There was a game show that always had a prize package for a weekend in the Poconos, and I don't remember if it was the dating game or the newlywed game. Do you remember that?
Probably both, because yeah. You're right. That was a huge, you know. Yeah.
You get a weekend to the Poconos. And they always showed the two couples all canoodling in that champagne glass. I don't know.
So weird. Who would have one of those? If anybody has one, let me know.
I don't know. Well, they also have like the heart-shaped beds. In the 40s and the 50s, the Poconos became a very fashionable place to take the family for a vacation. It's only a two-hour drive from New York and New Jersey. Jackie Gleason, Lucille Ball, Ed Sullivan, and even John F. Kennedy vacationed in the Poconos. In the summer, there was boating, golfing, swimming, and camping. And in the winter, you could ski in the mountains. Now, the Poconos is still a great vacation destination, but it just doesn't have the draw like it once did. All right, so let's get to the story. It was 10:45 p.m. on Sunday, January 21st, 1962, when Mrs. Young smelled smoke. She rolled over in her bed and looked out the window and thought, "All the lights are on at the Mapp's house. That's unusual." And she really did say she said that, because that was taken from the Pocono record, which I got most of the information from. She then realized the Mapp's house was on fire and immediately called the fire department. It took 2 minutes for the fire trucks to respond for what they thought would be a routine house fire. But they soon found out they were mistaken. Dun, dun, dun. So upon approaching the large two-story house that was approximately built around 1900s, they found all the doors had been locked from the outside with a key.
Oh.
Because the skeleton keys. Remember the skeleton keys?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The flames were so high, there was so much heat, they thought the windows were going to explode. The firemen were told by neighbors that the Mapp's family were most likely inside the house, so they rushed in to save them. Busting through the back door, firefighters entered the smoke-filled house. The heat was so intense and there was so much black smoke that filled the air, the firemen had to crawl around the ground to even see what was going on. Upon entering the kitchen, only 6 feet away from the raging fire, one of the firemen saw what he thought was a statue.
Uh-oh, is this a, it's never a statue mannequin kind of thing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He thought it was a statue, and for reasons why he thought it was a statue, I'll tell you later. As he inched closer, he saw that it was 22-year-old Christine Mapps lying unconscious on the floor, and she was holding a diaper in her bruised arms. He picked Christine up and carried her out to the porch to administer oxygen. Christine had burns on her face, and when the first responder spoke to her, Christine only mumbled. She was quickly rushed to the hospital, but unfortunately, Christine never regained consciousness and passed away at 2:40 a.m. on that Monday morning. It was later found out that Christine had a little smoke in her lungs, and she had died from a head fracture caused by a blunt object approximately 4 inches wide, and the bruises on her arm appeared to be from defending herself from the attacker. The coroner said her head was so crushed in that it was like she had hit a pole going 50 miles per hour. The firemen had to go back in and out of the house 6 times before they found 4-month-old Julie Louise. She was found face down between 2 cushions on a wicker couch about 15 feet from where her mother Christine was found. Julie Louise was covered with a pile of blankets and was naked from the waist down. That meant she didn't have a diaper on. Julie Louise did have second and third degree burns on less than 10% of her small body. She was rushed to the hospital by police car while an officer started to administer CPR, but little Julie Louise was already turning blue by the time they arrived at the hospital. She was pronounced dead on arrival. She had succumbed to smoke inhalation. The firemen went into the house 4 more times trying to find 39-year-old Edward Mapps, husband and father to Christine and Julie Louise, but they couldn't find him. The fire was easily put out. They had around 10 small fires that had been set up throughout the house using small piles of rags and papers. 2 of the fires were on the main floor. 7 were started in the attic, and there was 1 large one in the basement. No accelerant had been used, but someone did turn on the gas stove full blast and put the oven door open and set the temp to around 450 Fahrenheit or 233 Celsius. And I'm thinking they did that because the gas, there wasn't a flame, you know, it's a gas stove. Mm-hmm. So if you turn on the gas burners, that it would hopefully cause the house to explode.
Explode, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But because all the windows in the house were locked shut, the fire didn't get much air, and actually some of the fires went out on their own. So the fire chief, Nelson Leiter, said that the house would have been destroyed if the windows and the doors had been left open. So that's kind of what I already talked to you about. But
what's his last name?
Nelson Leiter, I believe.
Leiter, like, I'm going to set something on fire?
I believe so, and I think so, unless it's a typo, which it definitely could be a typo. We might need to look into that. But yes, Leiter. So once the fire had been put out, the search for Edward Mapp's body continued. They checked the surrounding area in case Edward may have gotten out of the house, only to lose consciousness. While they checked inside the garage, they found that both of Mapp's cars were still inside with keys in the ignitions. And just to let you know, I love papers from olden days, like 1962, and why, I don't know, but this paper made sure to note that the cars were foreign.
That's funny.
Yeah. He had two foreign cars. Yeah. And then the town, it was small. It didn't really have a lot of cabs and buses, you know, in this town. There were a few, but not many. And when they called around, there were no buses that left the town that night. No cabs have been called, and no one had seen Edward leaving the house at all. So Edward Mapps just disappeared into the cold, cold January night. 3 hours after the call to the fire department, a warrant for murder and arson bulletin was broadcasted to the PA State Police. Edward Howard Mapps was a wanted man. So let me give you a little back history on Edward here. It's kind of important for the story. Edward Mapps was born in June of 1922 to Howard and Bessie Mapps. He was the oldest of three kids, and the family used to summer in Bud Lake, New Jersey, which was only like a 40-minute drive to Stroudsburg. In grammar school, he was on the small side, and even though he was extremely intelligent, he was a mediocre student, kind of like you and me. In fact, he was actually held back a year in grammar school. He got his act together and graduated high school, and then he attended the Peekskill Military Academy. And in July of 1942, when Edward was 20, he joined the Marines. And that's where he served 9 months in Iwo Jima and Tinian before being discharged on November 1945. After Edward was discharged, he spent some time in a VA hospital due to mental illness, which possibly a nervous breakdown, like many men that served in World War II had, or any war after they returned from war.
Today it's post-traumatic stress, but yeah.
Edward was having hallucinations, and the doctors diagnosed him as a schizophrenic. And in his VA hospitals, he was described as, and this is them, not me. This was the VA hospital in the 1940s. He was described as retarded. Now, it's unsure whether Edward Mapps was actually schizophrenic. Nowadays, we call it PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, this term wasn't coined until the 1980s. All we know is that it was said that this only came up because of his time at war. So I'm going to just say it was PTSD.
I'm sure it was.
That's my non-medical opinion.
Thank you, Dr. Jin.
But it was reported that he was still having what they called schizophrenic reactions up until February of 1961. And we do know that he was getting a 30% VA disability pension for mental disease as service-connected ailment, along with a small monthly stipend from his trust fund after his father passed away. His father was a surgeon, by the way. Very well-known surgeon. So when Edward came back from the service, he used his GI Bill to enroll in the Syracuse University, where he majored in art and psychology. In 1951, Edward attended the Sculpturing Center. He was a very big artist, and he preferred sculptures. Hence why the fireman might have thought he saw a sculpture or a statue on the floor.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So in 1951, Edward attended a sculpturing center on West 69th in New York, but after a year, he was asked to leave on grounds that he displayed no interest in sculpting. Now, considering how much he loved to sculpt, many think that he had other distractions or maybe something to do with his mental health. The New York Daily News said that a year later, Edward lived in Greenwich Village with someone they called his common-law wife, and they had a daughter together. But after the daughter was born, the woman married a man from Israel. And I'm assuming that's correct because the media never lies to us. Edward was considered a beatnik, and by definition he was. And the definition is a young, artistic person who participated in a social movement of the 1950s and early 60s that rejects the customs of conventional society. That's a beatnik. So anyway, Edward didn't work a full-time job like most respectable men of the time. But when he did work, when he had to work, because maybe his VA pension wasn't enough or his trust fund didn't come through or something, he did take various jobs, like kind of menial jobs, elevator operator, bartender, dishwasher, just things to like get him from point A to point B, nothing on a serious career track. And he also didn't have a permanent residence. In fact, he would either couch surf at friends' house or he would live with older women. He loved those older ladies. Now, one of the jobs that Edward had was teaching art at the Henry Street Settlement House. And this is an organization that helps people on the Lower East Side, New Yorkers, through social services like arts and healthcare programs. And the programs include anywhere between preschool, Meals on Wheels, job readiness training, mental health counseling, you know, supportive housing to theater performances, stuff like that. And when I was reading on the website, I thought it was really cool. And I totally agree with this philosophy. The founder's philosophy is this, and I totally love it. Each of us is whole and worthy. Poverty is a social issue, not an individual failing. There's power in bridging differences. Neighbors matter. In times of need, act. Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
I like that. That'd be a big pillow to embroider that on. But I like it. Anyway, at this Henry Settlement House, that's where Edward met a strawberry blonde by the name of Christine Wallback. Christine was 19 years his junior and very naive and unworldly. She had just graduated from Adelphi College with a degree in home economics. Go 1960s.
Wow.
Even when they get married, on her marriage certificate, it says that she is a home economist. Now, it's kind of funny because Christine's father, Robert, he was an art teacher with the New York public school systems. So she liked her daddy, didn't she? They always say you marry your father, right?
Yep.
Now, Edwards, by all accounts, was a handsome man. He was 5'8", dark curly hair with a bit of gray. He smoked a pipe, and he was considered to be very charming. And he had his pick of any woman in the city. So I'm sure Christine was smitten from the get-go. The two married on October 20th, 1960, and rumor had it that Robert Wallback wasn't very happy about the marriage. It seems Robert didn't like Edward too much, but we'll get to that later. The two moved to Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania to live with Christine's parents. A while back, Robert had a heart attack, and he quit working at the... Robert, her father, I should say, had a heart attack, and so they moved out to Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania for the quieter life. The two moved there to live with her parents. In September of 1961, Christine gave birth to Julie Louise, and she's named after Christine's mother, Julia. In November, Edward purchased the 17-room house on Sarah Street as a birthday present to Christine, and they were in the process of renovating it at the time it caught on fire. Now that we have the backstory, let's get to the incident, shall we?
Let's.
All right. The crime scene held very little clues. When they went in, the only thing they found were Edward's leather wallet, and inside his ID and passport had been left, along with all of his stocks and bonds and his bank books. Next to Christine's body was found a plate that was stained with animal blood. When they tested it, they found it to be animal blood, but of course they didn't have the technology to find out what kind of animal blood, or if they did, it didn't say.
Right.
Investigators also found a kitchen chair, a slate block, and a woman's ice skate covered in animal fur.
I'm thinking he's an artist, so maybe he was doing something with that, like some sort of art thing? No? I don't know.
The maps,
I'm hoping.
The maps didn't own any animals, nor were there any dead animals found. And the police, it doesn't seem that they ever came up with a reason why they thought animal blood or fur was at the crime scene. It just was like a fact. This is what we found. They didn't delve into why it was there. They also found a 3x5 index card addressed to Julie Louise and in Christine's handwriting. The note was dated January 1962 at 5 p.m., but it wasn't signed. The card read, now this is weird. I think I know what it is. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Dear Julie Louise, we are still alive, but the day goes badly. I still feel the squirrel cage fantasy and baseless. Edward says you are the base, but that is unfair to you, although much of my work concerns you.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
Weird, huh? So a squirrel cage, I looked up, not only is a cage for squirrel, but there is also a motor called a squirrel cage. And what that basically is to me is like a hamster wheel.
Oh.
Right?
Huh. Yeah.
Now, Julie Louise was only 4 months old. So maybe she felt like she was doing as a new mother. Remember being a mother at 4 months old? Thank God the baby's still alive. I feel like it's Groundhog's Day. I keep running and running, but I'm not getting anywhere. That's what I take that as. Nobody ever went into what it was. That was just a note. It's very cryptic. And then the bloody animal, maybe it's some kind of weird art piece. I don't know. So this, of course, baffled the investigators and basically anybody who reads it. Here we are, have no idea what it is. And you're even an English teacher, right? You can read into it however you want, and everybody's going to find something else different with it. You know, and like I said, my impression is that Christine felt like she was getting nowhere, and no matter what she did, and being a mother, especially to a young baby, is like living in the movie Groundhog's Day. And maybe Christine had a bit of postpartum depression, too. You know, Julie Louise was only 4 months old, so.
Or maybe she was writing the note like a little keepsake for her daughter.
Well.
Did she ever keep a journal?
She did. That's my next thing. It's thought that this was supposed to go into Christine's diary, but she never got a chance to add it. You know, I remember with Steve would come home and he'd like, how's your day? And I'm like, well, we're still alive. They're still breathing, you know, because being being a new mother. And for me, a new mother meant being 34 years old. She was only 22.
Yeah.
You know, that it's an immense responsibility to keep a child alive. I mean, it's fairly easy to do, but still it's stressful.
It's just scary.
Yeah. Police learned that on the night of the murders, Edward, Christine, and Julie Louise had walked less than a block away to visit an old friend and neighbor, and they had brought her over a freshly baked pie, and actually it was so fresh it was still warm, and now I want pie. The trio arrived at 8:30 p.m. and left roughly at 9:05 p.m. It said everyone was in high spirits that night. So that would put the Mapps family back at the house by 9:10, and that probably would be like the latest that they would get back there. The fire inspector stated that the fire had been burning for approximately 40 minutes by the time it was called in, and the heat inside the house would have been too intense for anyone to still be inside. So this left less than an hour from when the Mapps arrived home to when the fire was set. So what had happened in that short period of time? Is 50 minutes enough time to attack his wife? Gather up trash and fabrics to put into 10 piles around the house, set them on fire, lock all the doors with a key, and then leave town on foot without anybody seeing him? It's not a very long time.
No, I mean, I think it could be done, but that leaving on foot thing, that's, I don't know.
But okay, he could have had a PTSD attack, but in 40 minutes, that just to do all of it for me sounds a little weird.
Unless he had it all planned out already. He had all the little piles ready to go. He had everything done, and all he had to do was kill her and set it on fire.
Maybe, but by all accounts, he loved his daughter, like fawned over her.
Yeah.
But anyway, years later, one of the policemen at the scene at the time of the murders was quoted in saying, I'll never figure out how he got out of town and out of the area as clean as a whistle. One of the men that helped the firemen that night was D.A. James Marsh. He'd lived not far from the Mapps and had seen the fire. And as written in the Pocono Record, as soon as Marsh heard that the baby was dead upon arrival at the hospital, he began to personally search for Mapps all over Monroe County. He made a state trooper escort him to 5 different diners, the bus and train stations, several residences in Bushkill and one in Polk Township. He woke up a justice of the peace, Floyd Kellogg, at 2 a.m. to swear out a warrant charging Mapps with homicide and murder. He ordered the state police fire investigator from Hazleton to meet him at 6 a.m. in Stroudsburg at the crime scene. A state trooper wrote dryly in his report on February 3, 1962, D.A. Marsh advised this writer that he was taking an active part in the current investigation. And by the way, I lifted all of that from the Pocono records because it was easier than me trying to write it in my own words. Just FYI.
I gotcha.
I don't want to be accused of them plagiarizing stuff.
No, you sure don't. Mm-mm.
Also, there is no indication now that James Marsh ever considered any other person for the crime besides Edward Mapps. He saw that Edward's Mapps wasn't there. And in fact, that's the only damning evidence they have against him, that his body was never found. That's what I'm about to tell you right now. Now, most of the evidence the police had against Edward was circumstantial at best. Mm-hmm. There was no motive whatsoever, and Edward had nothing to gain from killing his wife and daughter. The only thing that pointed to his guilt was that he disappeared without a trace. She had bruises on her arms that was like she was fighting off an attacker, although the baby did have some burns on her body, but she died of smoke inhalation. For weeks, police conducted extensive searches in wooded areas surrounding the town. Now, remember, Edward spent many summers in the area, and he also liked to look for fossils, and he would spend tons of hours in the woods. I mean, so much so that the town called him Nature Boy. And his car was always packed with fossils and rocks that he was out looking for, or just collecting.
So he was familiar with the area?
Very familiar with the area.
Okay.
State and local police and even some game wardens searched caves, hunting grounds, and empty cottages in Monroe County and the surrounding areas. When Edward's bank accounts were looked into, it showed that he had cashed a check the week before for $10.
Oh, I thought you were going to say $10,000. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, now yeah. I know. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. There's not enough money for Edwards to last any real amount of time, even in 1962, with $10.
Right.
D.A. James Marsh then appeared on the radio stating that if Edward turned himself in, that he would personally see to it that Edward would get to attend the funeral of Christine and Julie Louise. Marsh also promised Edward that he would receive every consideration, quote, due to a man with your intelligence. Marsh then went on to say that anyone that provided food, shelter, or clothing to Edward would be subject to prosecution at the highest extent of the law. But after interviewing many of Edward's female acquaintances, a lot of them said that they would hide him, basically. And one of the officers was quoted as saying, "Is I don't know what he had, but he sure had something."
Mm-hmm. The ladies liked him.
Now, the folks around Stroudsburg found Edward a bit off, and they didn't like his beatnik ways. Beatnik ways, I should say. The DA, James Marsh, believed Edward killed Christine and Julie Louise because, quote, Edward found marriage and the burden of paying a mortgage intolerable after years of carefree existence, unquote. And in a 4-page report typed after the fire, described Edwards, quote, he is a complete sponger, lazy, insolent, and nasty. Is not friends with any past acquaintances, and anyone who ever knew him does not speak well of him. End quote. And the kicker? It's also stated that the writer of the report was, quote, quite sure he was a homosexual.
Not that!
I know. The people didn't like him. He was unconventional.
Yeah, he was different.
He didn't have a job like all the other men did. He was getting money, I'm sure that they thought, for free. And honestly, I read a little bit about him. He seemed very snooty, like he was almost better than a lot of people. Like he spoke down to people. He did like an art festival. And the piece that he contributed was a great big canvas that was empty except for one red dot. And when asked about it, he stated, I just wanted to show what all the people in Stroudsburg knew about art, or that's all what they knew about art, like, or how little, I mean, you know what I mean?
Right,
kind
right.
of snotty and very, he looked down at his nose at people. Let's just put it that way. Or seemed to. Mm-hmm. So I can understand why some people might not like it.
Right. His dad was a doctor, right? So he had a nice upbringing.
Over the next few days, two residents of Stroudsburg reportedly received calls from Edward Mapps. The first being the founder of the Pocono Arts Center, Marcia Clapp DiRocco. She claimed a man saying, quote, This is John Birch, and you're next. Now, Marcia said that she recognized the voice as Edwards, but police dismissed the call and said it was a hoax. But to soothe, I guess, Marcia's mind, because she insisted that it was Edward Maps, and she knew him, that the police did keep her house under surveillance for like 24 hours for some time, just to keep her safe, just in case. The other call was made to a Henry Evans. Now, Henry is a retired executive who had been introduced to Edwards by Christine's father, Robert Wolbach. Robert and Henry were friends. Henry said that he received a telephone call while he was having breakfast at 8 a.m., and when his wife answered the phone, the caller politely asked for Evans by his first name, saying, "Please," but did not identify who he was, and Henry Evans recognized that it was Edward's voice. Now, the call goes something like this. Evans, or Henry, asked Edwards where he was, and Edward says, "I can't tell you now." And Evans claimed that Edward said, "I'm sorry for calling you so early. When you see Bob, I want you to tell him that I forgive him." Now, Henry didn't ask what he meant by this, of course, and then he told Edward to turn himself into the police. And then Edward said, "I can't do that." See, I'm trying to make him sound like Batman. I can't do that. Mm-hmm. Henry continued saying that sooner or later, you're going to have to turn yourself in. And Edward replied, "I have too many things to do."
So was this really him, or do we not know yet?
We don't know for sure. Okay. So then Edward changed the subject, saying, "I saw your painting at Wyckoff's department store. I liked the frame, but it was hung too high." Everybody's a critic, right?
I was just thinking, what an insult, too. I like the frame.
Evans then told police that Edward mumbled something that sounded like, "I want you to give my love to Julia," and then he hung up the phone. And of course, the police took this call seriously, and even when they contacted Julia Wolbach, she stated she believed that Edward did make the phone call too. So, but it's never proven. I mean, the caller never identified himself as Edward. And it's amazing what your mind can trick you into.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you think it's Edward. But of course, they never traced the call. I don't even know if they had those technologies back in the day or. So it's just said, it's taken that this really happened. Even though to me, it would be allegedly he called. Yeah. There's no proof. It's just he said, "This is what happened to me."
Mm-hmm. I agree.
The FBI was soon brought in, and they put Edward on the FBI's most wanted list for the federal charge of unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And it's funny because you can tell whoever gave the FBI the info on Edward, they didn't like him at all. Let me read it to you.
Not look very well.
The FBI describe Edward as a talented artist, and this was like on his, I guess, the poster for the most wanted list. So they describe Edward as a talented artist and sculptor, college graduate, avid outdoorsman, firearm expert, ex-marine, discharged for schizophrenia. Edward likes chess, swimming, a pipe, and eating. He's particularly fond of fried chicken or roast beef. Quote, "especially when someone else is paying the bill." He also enjoys going to taverns and drinking beer. He fancies himself a ladies' man and has a reputation of sponging off women, especially the elderly. Edward is reportedly resentful to society. He is a sloppy dresser with an unkempt appearance. He goes barefoot in the summertime and wears sandals with socks in the winter.
Oh, okay. Wow. Mm-hmm.
He frequently shuns wearing underwear and ordinary footwear and frequently skips bathing.
Yeah. Ugh. Is there anything worse than a man with funky junk?
I bet if he used the charcoal-activated ball wash by Ballsy, he would have cut the grime and not committed the crime. Or maybe even used a handy, too. You know, the handy is a perfect shower tool for making extra suds while gently exfoliating away the dead skin. Even comes with a never-drop strap, which is perfect if you go somewhere where you never want to drop the soap.
And, you know, no one wants to drop the soap, Jen. But just using the deodorizing sack spray will keep his swamp balls at bay. Just a spritz, that's all you need, of this pH balance spray on his brass clankers, and he could have felt refreshed while it soothed and moisturized his nads or really anywhere on his body.
And only a nut job would refuse a little nut rub. Nut rub is a salad cologne, which is perfect for on the go. I mean, and it's good for your body and your bollocks. Just a little bit of nut rub will make his giggleberries smelling fresh and not like a high school locker room. Plus, one nut rub lasts 2 entire months, and that's with doing it every day.
Our sponsors, Ballsy, have a great Valentine's Day gift set for you to give your man. The I'm Nuts About You Sack Pack set comes with ball wash, sack spray, and nut rub. You have your choice of 6 scents, but Drifts and Dunes is only available for a limited time.
And you know, I bet you our man Edward here, he might have preferred the smoke scent. Ha ha.
No doubt.
Sorry, I had to throw that in. But all of Ballsy's products are not only cruelty-free, but there are no sulfates, parabens, or synthetic dyes that could harm the man in your life's most sensitive parts. So give your man some below-the-belt care this Valentine's Day. Go to ballwash.com and order the I'm Nuts About You Sack Pack gift set and use our code TRUECRIME20 and receive 20% off your order. That's ballwash.com, order the I'm Nuts About You Sack Pack gift set and use TRUECRIME20 and you'll get 20% off your order. Your guy and his yam bag will thank you. All right. We love our friends at Ballsy. They're charming. They're incredibly charming.
And they're ballsy.
They're very ballsy. And it's fun. It's a fun brand.
It is fun.
And it's very needed.
And it does smell good.
Because seriously, after years of women being told about scents, whatever.
Taking care of yourself.
I don't even need to go into it. Women, you hear me. You understand. Some summer's eve, maybe we'll sit and talk about that. How's that?
That not so fresh feeling.
Yeah. So friends of acquaintances portray Edward as a totally different guy. They describe him as kind, intelligent, gentle. He loved animals. He skated with children in the streets. He collected arrowheads and fossils and all Indian artifacts around the Bushkill area near the Delaware River. And he had a very sly sense of humor. And he loved to drink beer. No one ever saw him drunk. And in fact, people said he refused to argue with anybody. If someone tried to start an argument with him, he would just walk away, which is so much better than me. I'd try to start the arguments, actually. And
Well, it's this, infuriating if you don't get that reaction back. You know?
I know, it
Ooh,
is.
Good.
It's worse than actual fight. Yeah, I totally get it. And then, honestly, this kind of made my heart bleed a little bit here. A month before the fire, Edward helped a neighbor care for her critically ill husband so she could go to work so that they wouldn't go into debt. And Edward visited the man every day until he died. Aww. The man was dying, and just seemed like a totally different than what the police took him to be.
I'm dying to find out if he did this or not.
Even though there was a wide difference of opinion on Edwards, everyone agreed 100% that Edward loved his wife and baby. He would proudly show off Julie Louise, and he loved to show her off. And as for his relationship with Christine, no one ever saw any signs of trouble or even heard them fight. Never even seen disagreement between them. There are also many sightings called into the police and the FBI. I mean, during this investigation, he had been seen in Cuba, supposedly seen in Cuba, in London and Bahamas, but nothing ever checked out. In fact, Time Life put out a magazine about the beatnik artists in Paris, actually. And one of the guys on the cover looked like Edward. But when they went to search for it, it wasn't Edward at all. And so there's some people saying he's living in Paris with the artists. But he's not, people. He wasn't. So in 1967, the Monroe County District Attorney, our friend James Marsh, requested that maps be removed from the FBI's most wanted list.
And why?
Many people think, we don't know, but many people think that he did it because of pressure put on him from the FBI, because there really was nothing to go on. And up until this time, Edward Mapps had been on the FBI's list the longest of anybody ever on, and it was like 4 years. Up until then, I think the most it was like 160 days, 4 months, 5 months. Yeah.
Personal vendetta.
Right. And remember, Marsh didn't really check into anybody else. Edward Mapps was legally declared dead on October 21st, 1977. My birthday. I was 8. But anyway, I digress. Now, though there's no proof that Edward is still alive or dead, it was done just so his siblings could settle his estate. The FBI destroyed the fugitive case file on Edward in December of 1977. FBI no longer has anything on him whatsoever. But the case isn't closed because there isn't a statute of limitations on murder in Pennsylvania. Or anywhere, really, I believe. Right? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm murder. Just assuming yeah. that? Murder has no statute. So I'm confused. This isn't the end, is it?
It's not the end. It isn't.
Okay, because I was like,
this
what?
Is the story that this never ends.
But I need to know. Like, it's bugging me.
I know.
I was just like, what? Okay, keep going. Sorry.
In 1993, a retired state police officer reopened the case. Now, this officer was actually the son of one of the original investigators. He remembers that when he was a kid, he remembers his dad, you know, going over the file and trying to figure this out, which is kind of interesting. During this reopening of the files, this retired officer uncovered details about the parents of Christine Mapps that were never revealed to the public.
Oh, no. I didn't go there.
Uh-huh. So they're thinking that all this information wasn't released because they wanted to keep embarrassment away. So when the file was opened, the investigator uncovered details about Christine's parents, the Robert and Julia Walbeck. It seems that they were having marital problems and just speculating, but they think it wasn't released because they didn't want the Walbecks to be embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want, you know, like they might not want everybody in town to know what was happening behind closed doors. Because you have to remember, back in 1962, divorce was very uncommon. I looked it up and the divorce rate was 2 out of every 1,000 Americans. Nowadays, it's like 600 or something like that. It's unreal. I mean, divorce rate is high now. It's a good thing if you need a divorce. But anyway, I digress. So after Christine and Julie Louise were pronounced dead, the police were sent to inform her parents. Now, we're going to go back and fill in some of the blanks where the police might have been missing some clues, or not missing clues, where they might have not divulged all the information.
Which could have been helpful, so, I'm sure.
I think it's very helpful, or at least we'll talk about it. After Christine and Julie Louise were pronounced dead, the police were sent to inform her parents. Now, the Walbecks at the time had been separated. Julia Hibbard Wallach lived in a room at Buck Hill Inn, where she had started working as a payroll clerk. Robert Walbeck was on an airplane from Miami to New York City, where he maintained a room at the Chesterfield Hotel in New York City. A family friend by the name of Walter Dreyer went to notify both parents to tell them what had happened to their daughter and their tiny granddaughter. Walter drove to Buck Hill Inn to take Julia to the hospital, but Julia could not bring herself to identify the bodies, so Walter did it for her. This brings us to roughly 4 a.m. Walter called the Chesterfield Hotel, where Robert usually stayed while in New York, but the hotel stated that Robert had not yet checked in. Robert Walbeck later told the police that he checked into his hotel at 3:15 a.m.
Somebody's not telling the truth.
Walter was not able to reach Robert until 8:10 that next morning, and there's no indication that this discrepancy was ever looked into by the police. Now, Robert's supposed alibi was he was traveling, right? He was on a plane.
Uh-huh.
He had purchased a ticket to Miami on December 6th, and he scheduled his return flight at 9:30 a.m. on January 21st. Robert claimed that he was on an Alaska Airlines flight from Miami to New York at the time of the fire. The reservation clerk at the airport told the FBI that Alaska Airlines did not fly out of Miami on January 21st. Robert would have flown on Paramount Airlines. Now, once again, we don't know if the police looked into this any further, but back then you didn't need ID to fly. You could purchase a ticket and get on. Or just find a ticket and get on. It wouldn't matter. They don't need your name at the time of travel. So we're not even sure if the person on the flight was actually Robert.
Really?
Right? Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But we don't know because we don't know if it was even looked into. Once Robert was told about the deaths, he left New York City by bus immediately, and Walter picked him up at the bus station and brought him to meet with the Strasburg police chief and the DA, our buddy James Marsh. And let me just say that the state police did not interview Robert at all until February 12th, 3 weeks after the fire. Robert did tell police that his daughter married Maps against his objections after knowing him for only 2 months. It was a very quick courting, let's put it that way. The Walbachs and Edward and Christine lived together in another house owned by the Walbachs. And according to Robert, Edward spent all day at the house. He never worked and just sat around reading newspapers and never paid for a thing. Somebody's angry. Robert claimed that Edward played up to his wife, Julia, and he acted as though he owned the entire house, even going as far as answering the phone saying, "Maps residence."
No.
Right? Uh-huh. And Robert claimed that their living situation had put Robert under terrific pressure. So Christine Maps gave birth to Julie Louise in September, and Julia, the mom, Mrs. Walbach, wanted to help her daughter and son-in-law purchase the residence on Sarah Street. Julia asked Robert to help Edward and Christine with money towards a down payment, and of course Robert refused and remarked that he was disgusted that Julia would put pressure on him to loan money to Edward. This is where it gets weird. It's reported that Robert didn't believe Edward was penniless, and he told Julia he would prove to her that Edward had money. And it was discovered after Edward disappeared that he had a $30,000 trust fund, which is roughly $600,000 today. Mm-hmm. And that's what he received his monthly pensions from. And I find it weird that Robert didn't know, or that Robert said, I'll prove it to you, Julia, that he doesn't have money. Because every place I looked, every article that I looked, even back from 1960, said that not only was he receiving pensions from the VA hospital or getting this trust fund, but every article mentioned, or almost every article mentioned, that Edward would make money selling his artwork, and he also played the stock market, and he was really good at playing the stock market.
Mm-hmm. And his dad was a doctor, so that makes sense that he had some money.
Well, with the trust fund, he would get the trust fund money, right? Uh-huh. And the VA pension. But, I mean, if all the newspaper articles, and I don't know, mentioned this, you would think mm-hmm. that Robert or Julia would have known that he played the stock market and all that. That's all I'm saying. So Robert told police that in October, when the baby was just a month old, Edward yelled at him about closing a door. And Robert slapped him in the face.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh.
And the report states, quote, "He served notice on the accused that he should be out of the premises by November 3rd, and that if he did not get his way, he would kill him," end quote. And Robert also said that he blamed Edward for destroying his marriage to Julia. Robert told all of this to the police, yet none of these events made Robert a suspect in Edward's disappearance whatsoever. So by November 3rd, Robert moved back to New York City, where he worked as an art supervisor for the city school system, like I said. And Julia moved into a small apartment, and Edward and Christine and the baby stayed with her until they moved into the house on Sarah Street. Now, Edward bought the house by himself, as far as I can tell, mm-hmm. for Christine's birthday.
So without money from her parents?
As far as I know, okay. Edward bought the house. Yep. So now Julie Walbach was questioned by the state police that night she found out about the murders, not 3 weeks after, like her husband got the pleasure to do. In fact, they searched her apartment at 1:45 in the morning to see if Edward was hiding there. And at that time that the police was searching her house, she told them that her husband hated Edward and was jealous of him.
Somebody's covering for somebody.
Julia claimed that on October 20th, Robert had, quote, "stormed into their home, kicked the television set, called her a tramp and a bum, and told her that if she did not get out of his way, he would kill her."
Oh.
Julia told police that she'd filed for divorce because she feared he would become violent towards her. And she also thought that Robert was mentally ill, and she had spoken to a doctor about how his behavior would get so violent.
Mm-hmm. That's what it sounded like to me.
Then it seemed that Robert had put a little bug into the police's ears, and so when the police questioned Julie, they asked her about a time when she and Edward stayed alone in her apartment. Robert had told her some things, and the police wanted to know what she had to say about the whole time. So Julia told them that Christine and the baby were in the hospital around Thanksgiving. I couldn't find out why. But Julia went into Edward's room, where he was already in bed, right? And she just went to say goodnight. At this moment, Robert shows up at the apartment and then accuses Julia of having sex with Edward. And Robert tells the police that Edward was naked and that Julia was wearing only a sheer nightgown. And Julia's like, no way in hell. I was not doing that. No, it's wrong. She denied it. To this day, if she was still alive, she'd deny it.
Yeah. Sounds like Robert's kind of lost his marbles a little bit. And I mean, I have a thing in my head that I'm thinking, but I'm not going to say
it yet. Okay. Well, we're almost done here. So the accusation of Julia Walbach being sexually intimate with her son-in-law and was somehow involved in his disappearance came up quite frequently with the police. And in fact, an FBI agent told the police that when he mentioned it and accused her of it, she just like kind of had this nervous breakdown and just cried. She couldn't even talk. She was just so upset.
That's awful.
And then a year after the fire, Julia went to Puerto Rico, and a trooper, this is horrible, a trooper actually wrote a letter to the police in San Juan, and the letter said, quote, "This investigator is quite certain that Mrs. Walbach and the wanted person, Edward Mapps, are very intimate with each other, and she will go any place to meet up with this person."
What?
Yeah, they're accusing her of...
I know what they're accusing her of, but why would that investigator say that?
They wanted the San Juan police to keep track of her and make sure maybe Edward's there. But let's go back. 3 months after the fire, Julia was finally given permission to go into the house on Sarah Street and get some of her belongings and some of Christine's and the baby's. Mm-hmm. And when she went in, she told her friend that all of Edward's sculptures had been smashed, completely smashed into pieces. And the Walbachs owned a lot of property in the area. And in fact, the house where they lived in before the divorce still belonged to them and it was unoccupied. And the Walbachs' house and the Mapps' new home were located back to back. So it was possible to walk out the back door of the Mapps' house, go across the alley and directly onto Robert Walbach's property. And in addition to the house, Julia and Robert owned a farm in Bushkill. The property was located near the top of the ridge above the Delaware River, and so today it's part of the Delaware Water Gap National Recreational Area.
Oh.
None of the police reports indicate that the Walbach farm was ever searched during this manhunt for Edward, and at one point, Julia told police that she believed Edward was dead and she felt his body was not too far from Stroudsburg. In fact, she stated, quote, "I cannot explain why I make such a statement, but that is the way I feel about it." End quote. There have been many debates on whether Edward Mapp was guilty or innocent. A year after the murders, a 62-year-old man who the paper reported with a, quote, good reputation, who knew Edward personally, made the following statement to the police, quote, "It is his opinion that possibly someone who had been hired by his father-in-law had committed the crime." The man then told police he believed Edward could be at the bottom of an unknown river or lake with a concrete block tied around his neck. And many of Edward's friends told the police that they believed that he had been kidnapped and possibly murdered. Now, as far as the retired state police officer that opened the case, he thought that this alleged call to Harvey was proof that Edwards was guilty because an innocent man would have said that he had been kidnapped, right? In a four-part article in the Pocono Record published in 2008, which a lot of this information came from, an 88-year-old niece of Julia Walbach by the name of Betty Metzger contacted the paper, and she said, quote, "Christine Walbach was my cousin. We never believed Ed killed her. He brought the baby to visit my mother many times. He loved her. I'll never believe he did it." And Metzger reported that at the time, 2008, that Robert Walbach had died several years prior, and that Julia was 98 and living in an out-of-state nursing home. Well, and she'd be well over 100 years old now, right?
Yeah.
And if by some miracle that Edwards is still alive, he'd be around 97. Unfortunately, we to this day know nothing about who killed Christine and her baby.
All right, so here's my thoughts. One of two things. If you hate this guy so bad, like your son-in-law, and you hate him so bad, what would be the worst thing that you could do to him? Like, your hatred for him surpasses your love for your daughter, right? You would kill your own daughter and your own granddaughter and try to blame him, right?
If he's crazy enough. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And not even saying that they were having an affair. What if the mother was with Edward, not with him, but like during that time when they were murdered? So she knew that he did not do it. He couldn't have done it because he wasn't there. He was with her. And so the mother is adamant that I know Edward did not do it, and she helped him run away.
Well,
what do you think?
I think Robert did it. I think he set the place up to have fires, and he was probably going to force Christine and the baby out. This is what I think of my Lifetime movie of the week thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when they came home, there was a fight, and maybe the father-in-law accidentally hit Christine.
Mm-hmm.
And she died, and then maybe Edward was hurt too, but managed to get away, and he left mm-hmm. knowing that he was going to get charged, kind of like the, you know, I don't mm-hmm. know, the Sam Shepard case, the fugitive.
Yeah.
I don't know. I still have this firm belief that Edward didn't do it. I can't say that Robert did it. And once again, it could have been the PTSD could have kicked in for some reason, but he only had 40 minutes to do everything. Edward left with nothing, no money, his no ID, nothing. Just the sandals and socks he was wearing.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of think he's dead, but.
Is dead.
No, I mean, I think he was probably dead then. And I think that the father-in-law hated him so badly that he set that up for him to look like he did it.
And here we go. We have Julia saying, yeah, he's dead. He's buried somewhere on the mm-hmm. Robert's property. Nobody checked, as far as we know, nobody checked Robert's house that was across the alleyway.
Right.
Robert could have drug his body out. I don't know. It's a mystery for the ages.
Where's Robert Stack when you need him?
I know. Hello. I would say Jack Palance, too, but he's in heaven. He knows the answers now.
He does.
He's on Solve Mysteries in Heaven.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, I just got that. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, if you guys have any thoughts on what would have happened, let us know. Either go to our website or even tweet at me on the Twitter or email us.
Yeah.
We would love to hear your thoughts.
Especially if you're up from that area, maybe.
Yeah. And you know a little bit about the case, although most, if I should say, your grandparents know about the case. But anyway, thanks for listening and stay tuned to listen to the promo from our friends at Dumb and Busted. And after that, you know, there's bloopers.
All right, Jen, remember, lock your doors.
Keep passing by those open windows.
Oh, bye-bye.
Love you. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all Our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at WeTalkOfDreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya.
Dumb and Busted has been called, quote, one of America's greatest treasures by 3 out of 3 hosts of the show.
Dumb and Busted is a weekly true crime comedy podcast with stories of exceptionally smart and insanely dumb crimes. Comedian Hunter Donaldson has hailed it as the greatest thing to come out of Portland since comedian Hunter Donaldson, who is me, also a host of the show.
Podcasters Allison Copeland and Hannah Ether praise Dumb and Busted as, quote, found on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Just more rave reviews from two other people who host the show.
Catch us every Thursday and follow us at Dumb and Busted on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Crime you later!
Now, Stroudsburg is the county seat of Monroe County, and that's main interest. And the main industry is Stroudsburg. Stroudsburg.
Beer.
No, I'm going to repeat it so you can keep doing it, but I'm going to repeat that sentence because I screwed it up.
I know. I'm not going to say anything. Go ahead.
In the 40s and the 50s, it became very. In the 40s and the 50s, the post. Fuck me. Let me do that again.
Hold on, real quick. Tess, you can't vacuum when I'm recording, babe. She said okay, and then she started vacuuming again. What is wrong with her? Are you done? Okay, you can't do that anymore. Okay, go ahead. Nico's gonna kill us.
So let's start. Okay. After busting through the back door, firefighters. Wow.
There's my dog barking. I swear to God. Hold on, Jen. You know
that it wasn't mentioned anything.
My dog's
what
barking,
is that?
Jen. It's my dog. Okay. Hold on.
Edward joined the Marines, when he was 20,
my God. Tess let her out.
The fireman had to go back in, and the fireman would go in and out of the house, and, I'm sorry, the fireman easily put out the fire. The firemen easily put out the fires.
Did the firemen easily put out the fire?
Thanks. Now that you said that, now I have to do it again. It's going to take me another 10 times. And
okay,
Nico's going to charge you for this.
I couldn't help it. That was a gimme. Okay, go ahead. I'll shut up. Oh, my God. Her, not him.